From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
What we're doing here is reworking our system to address those higher level, more violent, dangerous, alleged offenses, but at the same time addressing the vicious cycle of poverty. Today, we embark on a new chapter, a chapter of implementation.
That's State Representative Justin Slaughter. This week, Illinois became the first state to end cash bail, and we'll talk about the change and how things are going so far. Also, the Biden administration provides some help to cities dealing with an influx of migrant families, cities like Chicago. And once again, we inch closer to a possible federal government shutdown. Coming up on State Week, I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And our guest this week, Mawa Iqbal. She covers the State House for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio stations. And Mawa, it's good to have you back with us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So after months of talk, a lot of negotiations, legal action that took place, cash bail finally coming to an end in Illinois. We've been waiting for this for a long time to see how things were going to go. And Mawa, you were covering it, but you were also out even in court in some locations. How have things gone so far with this?
Yeah, so I actually went to the Sangamon County Courthouse the first and the second day of the new system. It was pretty interesting. The first day, they didn't have any new arrests the night before. So like Sunday evening after the law took effect. And so they didn't have any pretrial hearings under the new guidelines. But they did. They were continuing pretrial detention hearings from prior cases. And so it was interesting to watch a lot of the cases, you know, people were there on retail theft charges. So like stealing from County Market or Walmart, for example. And the public defender, you know, and almost all these cases would argue for an OR bond, which essentially just means being released on your own recognizance. And so you wouldn't have to pay a bond necessarily. You would just be released and sign a sheet that sort of says, you know, I promise that I'll show up to my next trial hearing. And so his argument for that was, you know, these charges are non-detainable under the new law. So therefore, people should not have to be detained and should not have to pay or post bond for them. The prosecution, however, argued that because these were charges that were incurred before the law went to effect, that they should be scrutinized under those old guidelines. So it's really fascinating to see. And then I talked to the state attorney, Dan Wright, and he had mentioned that according to the law, the people, the defendants can, you know, consult with their counsel for seeing if they can get a reconsideration. So if you've already been detained, right, you're already in custody, you were charged with something that before this new law went into effect on the 18th, you can request to get your bond reconsidered under the new guidelines. And so if you are, for example, detained for something like retail theft and you request and your request is granted to be reconsidered, you could potentially get your bail removed and then be released. So I guess now we're just seeing, you know, how many of those requests have been filed. Do the defendants even know about that? That sort of thing. But yeah, it's been very interesting to watch.
And Shirley, this just seems maybe like some growing pains with this. You know, these are some things that may not be there in a month or so, but we're going through that process because of this change right now.
Yeah, and this is, as Mawa said, we're just in the first couple of days of having this entirely new way of looking at people who are charged with crime. And the proponents, and I think Representative Slaughter alluded to this, argue that this is going to change a system where whether or not you are held in jail until your trial depends on whether or not you have money. And I saw one comment from one of the court watchers, I think it was in Chicago, along the lines that these bond hearings, they used to be just you run them through assembly line, the defendant comes up, prosecution says, we want Wheeler to be held on a $100,000 bond. Judge says, so ordered, bang, on to the next one. Now they actually have to consider each of these individuals. And for many low-level crimes, shoplifting, for example, if there is no reason for the prosecution, or the prosecution can't show why, if we release Wheeler on this shoplifting charge, he is a danger to someone, or he's going to flee, he's going to take off for Cuba or somewhere, and he won't show up for his next trial appearance, then he has to be released. And as a matter of fact, one of the judges who was handling this in Cook County was telling defendants, yes, you are free to go, but you better show up. If you miss your court date, you're going to be in real trouble. And on the other hand, people who before were able to walk and recommit violent acts, if they could post the bail, are going to be held in jail. And it's particularly in the case of domestic abusers, but it's still too early to see how this is all going to play out. And I thought one of the interesting comments came from our local sheriff here in Sangamon County, who said that it was uncertain. You know, before people were saying, with no cash bail, we'll have more crime. Will we or not? And will jails have fewer defendants or more defendants? Who knows? And I think his comment, and this is Sangamon County Sheriff Jack Campbell, says, I think in 3 months, we'll have a very good idea as to what the answer to all these questions are. And the chief judge for the 7th Judicial Circuit, which includes Sangamon County and several others, said, basically, we don't know the long-term effects. And he said to the reporter, talk to me in 3 or 6 months. So we're at the very beginning of this experiment. Probably we won't know for sure. And the judge said 3 or 6 months. I'm guessing we won't have a really good idea until maybe a year from now how well this has worked.
Yeah, Mawa, prosecutor, you mentioned Dan Wright. You talked to the prosecutor in Sangamon County, but at the same time, I would think these sheriffs are closer to this issue. They're the ones who have the people in jail. They're the ones that often, you know, are having to bring people back into jail if they're repeat offenders. You've talked to several of them, including some very small counties. And what did you find? What was on their mind when it comes to this law?
Yeah, so I spoke with the sheriffs from Cass County and Shelby County, which are in central Illinois, so it's not too far from us in Springfield. But they are very, very small, very rural counties. I believe Cass County's total population is 12,000. And so talking to them, it was very interesting. Both of them made the same or similar comment of like, you know, we are for bail reform. Obviously, we you know, believe that we should not hold people, or people shouldn't languish in jail just because they can't, you know, afford their way out. But we feel like this law would be better suited for bigger counties like Cook County, right, where they have very different problems with crime and public safety, where they have larger jail populations. And they were saying that here in Cass and Shelby County, they know everyone in the jails. I believe the Cass County Sheriff said that at any given point, there's only 10 people in the jail. And so he said that it's one of those things where there's never an issue with like a judge having someone sentenced to jail, and then they have a ridiculously high bond they have to pay. And so then they're just languishing there for months and months on end. And he was saying that for their counties in particular, drug use is a really big issue. And so, you know, of course, under this new law, unless you use a firearm or you cause great bodily harm, if you're arrested on a drug related offense, so like possession or even just distributing like a small amount, you can be released unless the prosecution is able to argue that you are a flight risk. Which what was interesting, the sheriff was saying that in most cases, if you're someone who is addicted to drugs, you wouldn't be considered a flight risk because you don't have money, and you're oftentimes homeless. And so, you know, that they're worried that with this new law, there's going to be issues of people like people who are distributing, people who are using, being out on the streets and back in these communities where drug use is rampant. And so, you know, there was a question of like, okay, now that we have this situation happening, you know, what do we do, right? Do we try to bolster our treatment options, or do we, you know, try to argue that they should be detained? And it brought up a really interesting question of like, what is the most effective way to help people who are particularly addicted to drugs? So that was one of the issues that I heard from sheriffs. The other ones that have been brought up to me were just procedural concerns. So like, you know, now sheriffs are going to have to prove that someone that they arrest, you know, if it's something for burglary, for example, which is another crime or offense that a lot of these smaller counties are worried about. They would have to prove that someone who has burglarized a home, if no one was at the home, like they would be considered a risk to the community. And the sheriffs were talking about how that would take a lot more time for the arresting officers to do that, just to file all that paperwork and also find more evidence, you know, that goes beyond probable cause, because under this new law, you would have to present clear evidence that this person is a danger to the community. So yeah, it was really interesting talking to them. Their concerns were mostly just that we have very different crimes here in these smaller counties versus what might be happening in Cook County. And a lot of our crimes would be non-detainable unless we can prove that they are dangerous. But yeah.
Yeah, Charlie, this, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead here because, as you mentioned, it's going to take several months to see how this works. But it strikes me that no law ever takes effect without the possibility, at least, of revisiting it, some tweaks to it that are made down the road. And these are the types of things that once we see how it all is playing out and some of these concerns, we could see some follow-up legislation to just maybe, again, tweak this law and some of these parameters that go with it.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, this law was passed in January of 2021 in the final hours of the previous General Assembly. And there was immediate criticism from law enforcement, from state's attorneys. They challenged it in court. It was upheld by the Illinois Supreme Court. But the General Assembly also made some adjustments in terms of trying to clarify exactly what the circumstances were under which someone could be held. And those were made even before the law actually took effect. And so, as you say, Sean, I'm pretty sure that once we have the experience and we've seen how this plays out, then there will be further changes made. One of the questions, for example, is what if the judges decide the condition for Wheeler to go without being held is that he has to wear electronic monitoring? And what happens if he steps off his property, goes out of the house and goes for a walk around the block? Is that going to be sufficient for him to be thrown back in jail? Those kinds of issues will have to be, as they come up, will have to be decided. And ultimately, as you say, Sean, I'm pretty sure the legislature will come in and do some, if you want to call it cleanup or tweaks or adjust the specifics of the law to fit the actual practices going on in the state's counties.
Also, there were some things coming up about electronic monitoring. And Mawa, I know you were helping report on that as well. What's the issue with electronic monitoring? It seems like one way to possibly allow people to go, but, you know, keep an eye on where they're at.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. The Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice, who's this coalition of advocacy groups that are really pushing for this law to go over the finish line, their main concern is the Illinois Supreme Court Office of Pretrial Services announced that they would be expanding their electronic monitoring program, and so offering it to at least 60 or 70 counties free of charge, you know, to use right while we roll out this new law. And the Pretrial Network's concerns were mainly just that, you know, with electronic monitoring, it's one of those where they believe that it's just another way of incarceration or just holding people in custody, because oftentimes people are only really allowed to go to work or to get groceries and then otherwise stay confined to their home. But they said sometimes, you know, that those parameters can be restrictive as far as where people can go, like maybe their workplace is far away, or maybe they're not even able to go to the grocery store, because sometimes judges will rule that they only have 2 days of free movement, which is basically just that they can go to these designated spots. And then at all the other days of the week, they have to stay within the parameters of their home. And so a lot of their concerns were just that, you know, if we're expanding the use of electronic monitoring, then it's going to be sort of a crutch or like a cudgel for a lot of these smaller counties to rely on instead of, you know, because now they won't be able to detain people on lower level misdemeanors, you know, then they'll just use electronic monitoring as an alternative, which I mean, I feel like, you know, I've heard sheriffs talk about how it could be a good thing, right? Because it does beat being in jail. At least they could be home. But then, of course, opponents of it say that it could potentially be a detriment because people might need to, maybe they don't have transportation to get to work. Maybe they don't, you know, have someone who can drop groceries off to them or medicine from the pharmacy and things like that. Very interesting to see how that would play out. But I would say I did see this one tweet from Hannah Meisel, who reports for Capital News Illinois. And she talked about how when she spoke with county officials from southeastern Illinois, they were saying that electronic monitoring might not even be a possibility for them because of broadband. So like connectivity issues, right? When you go out to those more rural areas, like how good will the connection be out there for tracking and monitoring where people go? So
good point. Well, we'll continue to follow this and won't be the last time we talk about the end of cash bail for sure. I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler and Illinois Public Radio's Mawa Iqbal. Charlie, I'll go to you because the Biden administration did take some action this week that had been waiting on. Certainly the cities like Chicago and many others, a lot of Democratic leaders have been pushing for this, to speed up work authorizations and other paperwork for Venezuelan migrants. And we know the Chicago area has seen thousands of migrants arriving over the past year, many of them coming from Texas, but not all of them hail from Venezuela. And it's becoming a problem in these cities to house and take care of these families. This action this week, I guess it's a partial victory for some of these cities and city leaders. Is that a way to look at it?
Yeah, I think that is a good way to look at it. And more than partial, it's pretty much complete in terms of what Governor Pritzker and Mayor Johnson and officials in New York and elsewhere had asked of the federal government, allowing migrants to work while they seek asylum. So what happened earlier this week, the Homeland Security Department announced that I think it was around 472,000 Venezuelans who had entered the country by the end of July of this year will receive something called temporary protected status, which fast tracks their ability to do legal work. It's a way for them to basically qualify for work permits that would allow them to take jobs. And of course, here in Illinois, the governor and Mayor Johnson and others were praising President Biden for taking this step because the state faces labor shortages in a number of industries. And as we've mentioned before on the show, these folks who come here from Venezuela are very eager to go to work. And so they will now have a fast track where instead of waiting maybe months or years to be able to work legally, if all goes well, they hope to be able to do it in a month or so that these able-bodied, willing workers can take the jobs that are waiting for them. So this is a plus, I think, for everybody all the way around.
And they'll pay taxes by working that. So it puts them on the payroll. Sure. So that helps the city. Now, I guess my question is, why only Venezuelan immigrants? You know, because there are immigrants coming in from other locations as well. Why did they only single out that country?
Venezuela is, in a sense, is almost a failed country. A lot of the immigrants who arrive from other nations are here for economic reasons. The people who are coming from Venezuela, on the other hand, basically are coming for political reasons because they're, for want of a better term, their nation is a failed nation. And so they are folks, many of them are professionals, and the majority of them have had a very arduous journey walking or taking transportation from Venezuela to get up to the United States. And part of that involves going through something called the Darien Gap, which is basically jungle between the eastern portion of Panama and the northwestern portion of Colombia. And so these folks had to trek through the jungle en route to get here, not coming because of economic reasons. They're coming because of the political conditions in their home country. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the same category that would apply, for example, to immigrants from Ukraine or immigrants from Afghanistan.
With a few minutes left here, Mawa, I did want to touch on a story that you reported on a few weeks back now, but it's an interesting story. You took a look at the number of what are known as crisis pregnancy centers in the state of Illinois and compared that to abortion clinics. I guess before we get to what the numbers show, explain to people what a crisis pregnancy center is. They may not be aware of that.
Yeah, so a crisis pregnancy center is essentially a limited pregnancy center, is another word for it. And they basically are these nonprofit organizations that are often run by local Christian ministries. And they operate as a women's health clinic, if you will, except they don't offer the full range of reproductive services. And so they will offer ultrasounds and pregnancy testing, STI testing. But the one thing they don't offer, and what has caused a lot of buzz, is abortion services, nor will they refer for them. And so a lot of these CPCs will try to sort of present options to people coming in if they're considering abortion, to be like, oh, well, you might be considering abortion, but also have you thought about parenting? Have you thought about adoption? And they do have, like, you know, information, flyers, classes for people interested in parenting or adoption, but there definitely is a very hard sway against, you know, really referring for or encouraging, I should say, abortion services.
And what did your reporting find out as far as how many of these facilities exist and then comparing it to the abortion clinics?
Yeah, so among the 102 counties in Illinois, 42 have crisis pregnancy centers, but no in-person abortion providers. And so basically what we found was the crisis pregnancy centers outnumbered abortion providers in Illinois by nearly three. So for every one abortion provider, there were almost three crisis pregnancy centers in the area. The data work was done by my colleague, Claire Kurgan, who works on the data team. And it was really fascinating to look at. You know, she put it on a map, right? She illustrated it all on a map. And for a lot of, especially more like rural counties in central and southern Illinois, it's really, I mean, the only clinic that you would have access to would be a crisis pregnancy center. So if you were looking for something nearby, you know, if you were someone who was pregnant and maybe considering abortion, the only place you'd be able to go to would be one of these centers and not an abortion clinic. For those, you'd have to drive a little bit more. So it was pretty fascinating. I mean, and you know, we spoke with the researcher out of UGA, University of Georgia, and she created this map, national map of crisis pregnancy centers from her research. And she was telling us that basically their strategy is to sort of pop up in a lot of places where access to healthcare is kind of minimum. And so, you know, just to sort of fill that hole and to make sure that the people who might think about going to abortion providers will instead go to their center just because it's closer to them. So this is, she said it was definitely a strategy for a lot of these centers to sort of target these areas where there aren't really other resources around. So,
of course, there was some legislation that moved through that was targeting these crisis pregnancy centers. Fill us in again on what did that do? And this was pushed by the Democratic majority in the Illinois General Assembly.
Yeah, so basically this legislation allowed for people who had gone to these centers to file, if they felt like they were deceived or misled or they were fed misinformation from these centers, then they would have an avenue to file a lawsuit against the centers through the Attorney General's office under the Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Practices Act. Abortion providers or abortion funds who work with people who had gone to a crisis pregnancy center first will say, just like anecdotally, that a lot of these people would be lied to about their gestational age, for example. So like if they go to a pregnancy center and they say, oh, you're actually much further along in your pregnancy, you know, and so you can't get an abortion because it's too late for you. A lot of times that ends up being not true. And it's just another tactic to dissuade the patient from receiving an abortion.
It's time for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's start with you.
The Illinois Gaming Board released its report with the numbers on casino gaming and video slot machines earlier this week. And it showed that August was a pretty good month for casinos in Illinois. And September is going to be even better. The state's 14 operating casinos raked in more than $124 million in adjusted gross receipts from some 920,000 customers in the month of August. And the reason September is going to be better is because they'll include the initial report from the state's first Chicago casino, the Bally's Casino, which is in temporary headquarters at the former Medina Temple on North Wabash Avenue in River North. It opened on September 9th. The state's main gaming attraction appears to be some 47,000 video gaming terminals at more than 8,400 establishments from the state line in Wisconsin down to the Ohio River. Bettors plunked down almost $2.7 billion last month and won roughly $2.3 billion, according to the Gaming Board. And as we've noted before, leading the way, it's been the case almost since video gaming was legalized, back in 2009, is the city of Springfield, which has 773 gaming terminals at 142 establishments, the most by far of any community in the state. And those terminals produced $1.2 million for the state and more than $210,000 for the city in August, according to the Gaming Board.
All right. And Mawa.
Yeah, so the news that I've been covering this week that hasn't been cash bail has been a potential federal shutdown. Basically, what's happening is Congress is trying to pass these 12 appropriations bills, which would fund things like the National Park Service and the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. And so they agreed to these bills in June. They negotiated with President Joe Biden, leaders from both the House and the Senate, and everyone came to an agreement on the spending. But this block of far-right House Republicans have been trying to basically stop the bills from advancing and just not vote during the more procedural committee hearings for these bills. And so now it's kind of up to Speaker Kevin McCarthy to either bring these bills forward, knowing that this group of House Republicans, this small group of House Republicans, are not for it, or try to get them to be for it and to pass the bills. But they have 8 days to do it. And it's the more articles I'm reading about it, that the more it seems like it's not going to happen. Like they won't be able to pass all 12 appropriations bills in the next 8 days. And so in that case, there would be a government shutdown for at least a little bit. I did talk to someone, John Shaw from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute yesterday. And he expects that it won't be a very long shutdown, which is good. Like it will probably only last for a couple of days. And after a couple of days, they will pass like a temporary funding bill just to sort of keep the lights on.
Well, we'll see what happens. That wraps up this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Illinois Public Radio's Mawa Iqbal. You can find our show where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.